Welcome to the Immeasurable Podcast. This series reflects upon Krishnamurti's work and how it directly impacts the listener. Included are interviews of people who have spent time with Krishnamurti himself, as well as those looking at what his teachings point toward today. Also included are original recordings of Krishnamurti's talks, discussions, and interviews. Each podcast invites the listener to look for themselves through self-inquiry and to continue the exploration in one of our online communities or during one of our programs at the Krishnamurti Center in Ojai, California.
There are four of us today sitting in Pine Cottage, which is the Krishnamurti Library in Ojai, California. Like I said, there's four of us. We each facilitate different dialogues and or programs at the center here, at other centers worldwide, and at the school in Ojai on the other side of the valley, Oak Grove School. So we are going to read a passage, the first paragraph of the core of the teachings, and then just sort of open it up and look at it together. So we'll introduce ourselves and then read the passage.
My name is Jackie McKinley, and as Corey said, I facilitate programs here and dialogues, and I also travel to different places in the world where I do the same thing.
My name is Mary Kelly. I've been deeply interested in the teaching since I was quite young and engage with exploring the teachings with my fifth graders at Oak Grove School, perhaps the most favorite thing that I do while there. And I also coordinate some of the dialogues both at Oak Grove and at the KFA.
And my name is John Duncan. I am a librarian here at the Pine Cottage, and I host the Tuesday night dialogues every week here. So if you've been here, I've probably met you.
And I'm Corey Fisher. I more recently have become involved in facilitating silent retreats here at the center in Ojai and participating in the Explorations Conference that we hold in the late spring, also in Ojai.
So now I'll read the passage, the first paragraph, unless...
Can I maybe introduce what we're reading?
Please.
Where it came out of and all
yeah.
that, just real quickly?
Yeah.
So it was mentioned that we're going to read and discuss or discuss about how we inquire also, but a piece from something called The Core of the Teachings. And what this is something that Krishnamurti was asked to write out by Mary Lutyens, who was writing his biography. And she asked him, can you basically put everything you've talked about in 65 years into five or six paragraphs? And he did it. And it's been titled The Core of the Teachings. And it's available on our website. And it's also available on jkrishnamurti.org to read the entire thing. If you want to read along with it, maybe we'll post it even. And so it's five paragraphs. And in another podcast, we'll go through the whole thing sort of explanation-wise. But this is something different. This is an inquiry beyond through the words. And just, again, before we read it, it begins with something he said in 1929 when he was disbanding the organization built around him. And that is that truth is a pathless land. And that's one of his seminal insights. And he kept coming back to that later in his life as saying, yes, that was like my core insight. So there's a whole huge amount to understand in those five words. And that's, we're going to talk about what does it mean to understand or go through beyond understanding, I think, also as we read this. And so Mary's now going to read that first paragraph.
So it begins, truth is a pathless land. Man cannot come to it through any organization, through any creed, through any dogma, priest, or ritual, not through any philosophic knowledge or psychological technique. He has to find it through the mirror of relationship, through the understanding of the contents of his own mind, through observation, and not through intellectual analysis or introspective dissection. And perhaps a question we can begin with is, what is it that dialogue invites us to engage with? Or what is it about dialogue that is unique, a unique approach to exploring something such as this?
Yes, I feel the unique quality, Mary. I feel that needs to come out. Yes. That there seems to be something normally people come together when they're in a circle and they share, they learn. And learning is usually based on an exchange of knowledge, isn't it? I mean, it's not just because Krishnamurti has talked about knowledge. It really is a fact that in our world, that's what we do. So anybody who comes to a dialogue would be forgiven for assuming that they were going to actually learn something that they could understand, it would then become a new tool, and they could use this understanding and this learning later on. But is that what takes place in dialogue? Is there something to learn in a concrete sense that one can use later? Or is it about something other than that?
Somehow the way to connect looking at dialogue, but also looking specifically at this paragraph, something about the value is in the approach specifically, and not necessarily even what's being approached. And I think that's like where the uniqueness comes from, is that because what I hear you saying, Jackie, is basically when we typically have a conversation, the value of the conversation is what we're conversing about and what we're exchanging. And I think what's captivating about even the words truth is a pathless land and captivating about dialogue is that you're sort of collapsed into how do you even approach something like that? And how do you approach one another outside of sharing this or that value or this or that idea? Something, so it's like turning the lens the other way. Somehow that's where I see them meeting, the two things.
And it seems that it's like a simultaneous act of continuously inviting this immeasurable kind of learning that may be possible, but also observing when there is that conditioned response to acquire something, to learn something in order to use it, or to walk away feeling, I don't know, it seems that sometimes the goal, without us even being aware of it, is to agree, is to feel that we all have seen something together that means it therefore must be the truth. And it's important to be honest with ourselves when we come to things like this, to see the subtle ways that that is the tendency. That's the way that the mind works. That's thinking, ultimately. So it's like this interplay between seeing that through observation and then relinquishing sort of the attachment to it, and then being open to whatever else is possible.
So that implies what is possible is going to take place in some form of relationship, like you were saying, Corey, to turning the lens inward means relationship to possibly one's own thoughts, more so than the person across the room at some point. Even though you're relating to the person across the room, it may inspire a thought coming up like, oh God, there's Corey going again. Where I'm not related to you anymore, I'm actually relating, or if I am, I'm relating to my idea of you. And if I react to that, then I'm still not relating to you, I'm relating to my thoughts. So the primary thing that's going on in that situation is my thought moving and creating an experience singular to myself. And that's where the relationship is, you know, sort of unfortunately in the entire world today. And the other thing I was going to relate in, based on what you were saying, Mary, is dialogue. I've heard it explained, and whether it's correct or not, dialogos meaning to go through the word, not by the word, but through the word, meaning, say, whether we're speaking or reading something Krishnamurti spoke, these are coming from silence into sound, and what is actually being communicated, you know? Are we seeing the menu, or are we actually eating the food, as it were, and the words are sort of the menu? So to be able to go through the word and have it reveal meaning, which may give you an even better description in words of what the original words were, but also a feeling or a relationship to, like you were talking about, that kind of different kind of relationship, more to the moment. And that is, coming back to the reading, pathless. There's no predestination to that kind of understanding.
I'm feeling compelled to bring in the word listening because whenever I hear the word pathless, I think to myself, what is it that attempts to create paths that I might follow in order to know where I'm going? And it seems to me that what creates those pathways is the act of thinking, thought about something that moves me in a certain direction or away from a certain direction. Whereas it seems to me that the invitation to listen, wherein thought is not guiding the exploration, that's pathless. Because it's as if in that moment, no matter what is heard, it's a value, whether what is heard or observed or listened to is one's own thoughts, whereby we become better acquainted with who we actually are or what we are made up of, or whether it is truth that is spoken by another. It's almost as if both are as valuable if listening for listening's sake is of essence.
I think that's interesting to unpack more. Maybe I'm kind of seeing it from the other side, just more to, I think it's really interesting to understand how we're using the word path, because we're speaking about it, it sounds like, pretty specifically. And I understand how you're meaning it because I kind of share that understanding. But like, what I hear you saying is that it's somehow a path that's like the mind moving down a trajectory, and that can be because of wanting to feel something or not to feel something, or wanting to understand something in a specific way, or trying to find how I agree or disagree, or trying to avoid conflict or disagreement. All these different
there's
things
an
are
end
like
goal. There's
a
end.
Way in which my mind is primed, which is like a path is something you can sort of look down and it takes you to a very specific destination. I don't think that we see that having a motive in that drives how I'm thinking about something, or having a resistance to a kind of feeling builds a path, builds a trajectory in my mind. It's not clear. That's not how we relate to our own minds usually. So it feels as though this thing is true because it's clear and it moves forward and it brings me somewhere. So that space is interesting because it happens of its own accord, and it really is how our minds work. Like, we build these ways in which we move.
Yeah, I'm finding this very interesting because I've never thought about this before. I've never looked at this specifically, this idea of the path. And as you're speaking, I'm asking myself the question, well, how do paths start in the first place? Because you just have land, and then a path is created, isn't it? Because it's well worn. We walk on it, we walk back, we walk again on it, we walk again. And then when I look at the land, I'll follow the path because I don't want to walk where nobody else has walked or where I myself have never walked. Now, why is it in the human being, just as we created these paths in tribal communities and way back in the past, why is it that we prefer to take the path? I mean, keeping with what you were saying, I'm not moving away from it, but why is it that we prefer to take the path than not take the path?
I think that gets into our our false sense of security with the known. It seems that the unknown, even though perhaps it promises to deliver us from our suffering, or maybe it doesn't, it's terrifying. We'd rather do what is familiar, and if not familiar, at least someone's done it once before. Yeah, it seems that the not knowing, as much as we might say we're interested in it, it ultimately means the death of everything we know, or at least questioning deeply everything that we think we know
right.
And rely upon.
Right, so I feel here we have to clarify the outward world, like the example that was given there, that a path is actually created in a landscape, and that there, perhaps, there was a meaning behind that. It made sense to do that rather than wander off and face all kinds of dangerous animals, for example. But why is it, what is the difference? If outwardly it's okay, what's the problem inwardly? That is touching on what you're saying, but like keeping it really at a kind of basic, easy level that everybody can understand, like even a child might be able to.
You're saying outwardly it's okay, because like if you want to get it to the top of a mountain, any hiking, you would be better off taking a path than bushwhacking.
But much
what,
safer.
And then when you're talking about inwardly, what are you talking about the path is leading towards? In quotes, what is
Yeah, I'm wondering
what is that path we're on?
I'm wondering.
What is at the end?
Yeah, what's the, but my question was, what is the, there's obviously, it's okay outwardly to get to the top of the mountain, much more practical to take the path. What's the problem inwardly? And Mary was pointing to it, but I feel like we could go really slowly into that. What's the problem there?
But what is at the end of the path that we're on a path for? Or are we just on a path thinking that the security is the path itself?
Oh, I see. That's
the conformity.
Your question. Inwardly.
There's the top of the mountain outwardly. What's the top of the mountain inwardly?
So outwardly, I'm thinking of a physical body that's moving across a path to get to a certain destination in the most efficient, hopefully safe manner, way. And inwardly, the body or the being that I'm envisioning is the self that we have created, which is moving along certain paths that further strengthen and further identify, further add layers of identification to the survival of that. Such that, you know, that's why it seems that the self is always pursuing what is already known to it and what further defines it as something real. I don't know if that's...
So something we created, and then the whole modus operandi is just the furtherance of that which we created.
The becoming.
Yeah, and the perfection, the supposed or potential, perfection, which would be a sense of complete security and or freedom, if those may be the same.
So thing. Are you saying that's the end of the road inwardly, is a sense of security?
As an ideal.
As an ideal.
And it's never achieved, so it's ongoing, and it gives the sense that one is learning, per se. I mean, again, we can go back to the whole notion of learning and why we feel it's so important. It's in order to acquire knowledge, whether about the world outside or the world inside.
Yeah, if you look at science is probably the most objective thing there is. And I was thinking about this the other day. We used to sail by the North Star, because it doesn't move, right? And with sincere objective interest in perfecting that, because it wasn't always a perfect, you know, science, we now sail, we put our own star up in the sky. We put GPS satellites up in the sky. And through all climbing up that mountain, we have made that journey much more efficient. And it's an objective thing. But if you look at then like politics, which is much more subjective, an idea of democracy, and you see it gets polluted with all this idea of my security versus your security and this and that, it's a much less clean outcome. In other words, no one's going to get killed by a GPS satellite, and it's kind of a beautiful thing to be able to drive around LA and use your GPS versus the Thomas guide. And but politics, you know, or religion, this kind of these other things that are seeking security or that freedom have a investment in them which is subjective and not objective. It's there's a fear of losing it to your idea or, you know. So
I think there's something about this. I'm like listening to everything. There's a part of this that I just want to expose, because I think it's really easy to explain this kind of thing and sneak in some deep volitionary intent or some kind of... So I guess the other way to say that is, I think it's important to clarify that everything we're discussing is entirely automatic, and no choice of our own has ever been a part of building what's happening. So we don't get to choose our way out of it. We don't get to decide we're no longer going to take paths and stop taking them. It's more like, to describe it another way, if you and I have a conflict, we get in a frustrating argument and then we resolve it, we're both going to somehow record that experience, and it will, on some level, maybe a big level, maybe a small level, be a benchmark for the next time a similar experience happens. That's the foundation of a kind of path. My intention was never there to lay that path. I was not actively recording that path, but there is some deep, automated path building thing in all of us. Yeah, that is the machinery. Way our minds work. Machinery. I'm trying to avoid words like that because I don't want to overuse, I don't want to make it sound too mechanical, because it's living and it's what we live in. And so it's interesting to try and discuss it while also keeping it clear that none of us have ever had anything to do with it. We've never chosen it. We may feel as though we're in control of these paths and decide the ones that we like and get rid of the ones that we don't. But even that is highly questionable. So I don't know. I just felt like bringing that in because it's, there's something, I think, why it's so important to attempt to discuss these things is exactly because we're so in control of these things, but we don't think that we are. We think that we have some freedom from them to be able to manipulate them. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we...
But when you say we didn't choose them, what does that mean?
I guess... even when I attempt to look at the way in which I may be conditioned to move in certain ways, to think in certain ways, to feel in certain ways, even my initial approach to those may contain some false sense of freedom from them that gives me the ability to see them objectively and to move away from them or to decide I don't want them. But so all I'm trying to say is that these things are so deeply ingrained in how our mind works, it's actually very, very difficult for us to see them for what they are and not to delude ourselves into thinking that we're somehow this entity that takes the path and walks the path, but not the entity that's made of these paths. I keep coming back to how do you approach looking at these without building the wrong kind of some omnipotent perspective within yourself that has the freedom to, I don't know, to look at them clearly. I don't think that we can see them. Maybe we can, but we have to be careful, because I think it's much easier for us to build pictures, which I guess are themselves different kinds of paths, because it's easier to understand a picture of myself that I can paint, even if I decide it's out of paths, than it is to approach them directly, which I think is the whole point in a way. Is there a way to approach something directly?
Well, something Mary said about 10 minutes ago, then we kind of got off into, like you say, the explaining part of stuff, which is also very good.
But, yeah, for sure.
But if we were talking about what is dialogue and how we don't do what you just said, in other words, have this me try to fix this me, or this, you know, create another path that's the fixing path or whatever it is. you said something at the very end of what you said. He said, can it be that listening is essence? And that stuck with me. And that listening, because she said she wanted to bring up listening. And if listening is essence, that implies that it's something real and living and of the body, not something we're doing within the body. You know what I mean? It's there to begin with. It's like breath, you know. And it's like breath, it's right there, right now. So the deeper aspect of that word listening is coming to mind.
I really want to come back to what you were saying, Corey, that these paths are somehow, I can't remember exactly what you said, but I feel this is absolutely essential because of what you said points to the fact that there is, it kind of dries up the whole approach with thought. It means that the only thing left to us is observation, isn't it? And I think this is absolutely crucial to dialogue because it seems to be very hard for all of us to step away from the automatic and the cognitive approach that we have to everything in our life. It's just happening inside of ourselves, as you say, without our control. And what's gonna make us jump from that natural movement that's happening all the time automatically into seeing that movement? And I feel this is a key to dialogue and whether it happens or doesn't happen. So I would like to go into that a bit more with you all.
I mean, it sounds very similar. It sounds essentially, I mean, if I'm hearing everything the way you're meaning it, the way you're using the word observation is, I think, kind of the way you're both using the word listening. It's the same space.
I was just about to say that.
That's good to bring that together.
It sounds like the same area.
Yeah. But we need to maybe clarify that also. Mm-hmm. Because we may think it's the same, but it might not be.
And I'd like to bring in a few other things, because I do think that they all come together. And they are their own words, so we'll have to, I'm sure, explore them as such. But what I've come to find about dialogue, what seems to be the invitation that no one person has ever given me, but that seems to be there. It seems that dialogue invites those participating in it to be in love, not in the romantic sense, but when you were saying something to do with what is it that allows us to observe or to listen, what keeps coming up for me is this notion of unconditional love that can see and take in and receive and be in contact with everything that is observed, everything that is heard. It has no sort of boundary that would separate the right from the wrong, the agreeable to the disagreeable. And then again, we bring in this the words that he himself uses, Krishnamurti uses so often, which is the mirror of relationship. Earlier, John, you were speaking about how so often what is seen in dialogue when we become aware of our own thought process, our own evaluation process, is our relationship to our own thoughts and how it's the thoughts and images that are really in relationship with the person speaking. Usually. And so again, it seems that the mirror of relationship that is possible in a dialogue is what is showing us what our relationship is, not only to one another, but to everything. And the only way all of it can be seen for what it is through love, such that whatever is seen is loved. Again, I'll just bring in one more image that often comes up for me, and it's the love, which is problematic, but it's the love a mother has for her child. It seems that no matter what, deeply, the mother loves the child, whether it's, you know, misbehaving or being really cute and so on. And again, a mother's relationship to her child is problematic because there's all kinds of other ways that we live vicariously through our children. But love is what keeps coming up for me in terms of what is it that allows us to surrender to this listening, which has no controller, this observation that in and of itself is what reveals to us the truth. So I know I've just brought in quite a few.
You brought in the big word.
I did. I'm sorry. And it wasn't because it's overused. It was just, it kept coming up.
I mean, to go off of that, though, one interesting thing, way to even look at that is just to if I really attempt to take that stance and to legitimately, just even within my own experience, not move a single hair away from anything I'm experiencing at all, that would be making an attempt to move into this space you're describing.
The moment you said stance, I said, no, that's not the same.
Yeah.
Because it's not something one does or chooses to do.
Well, no, I'm not even saying that. Just more, so what I'm getting at is even to see how challenging that is to not move at all, not move away, not move towards, not grope for this or deny that, whatever, is itself, I think, the first glimmer of seeing something real. Because then you see that whole activity and how immediate it is and how automatic it goes. And so that can make love very small but very impactful, is that first moment when you see that it's very difficult to love because there's a lot of weird things. There's a lot of things that hurt, and there's a lot of things that are very confusing and don't make sense logically. All these things are equally included in what you're describing. So it's like, again, I keep coming back, it's like the opportunity is the initial attempt, and it's not necessarily even about striving for love, but it's like seeing what's there if you even look for it. Like, if that exists and you try and find it or even attempt to undergo it, see all the things that happen and see, does that make sense?
It does.
That seems to be the opportunity. So,
are you saying to see something without looking for it?
Or to see what happens when you try to look for something. Immediately, what happens?
Mm.
Where do you go to look? What do you conjure? Like, do you start thinking about something? Do you start, like, do you contract in certain parts of your, where are you going?
In fact,
embodied, very like, what is your active, like when you attempt to look, that first step, what are you actually doing? And very often you're doing a lot. You're avoiding this thing. You're picking this area to stay in.
So
I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. And you know, and I'm trying to say it in a really, the most kind of bare-boned way that is possible. So you're saying looking, if I'm going to look for something, I'm seeing that is the beginning of path, isn't it? It must be, because if I look for something, it means I'm going to be taking a step And it's something outside of me, and it's something I'm going towards. So then what's coming up is there a difference between this looking for and seeing? And what is that difference? If there is one.
Well, if you're looking for something, you obviously have an idea of what you're looking for, and it's either coming out of a need or desire, right? I want security, and there it is in that fancy new car or whatever it is. And it's an action, and it's an action coming out of insecurity in that example. But the unique thing about observation and listening, as we were mentioning them earlier, is those are not actions. Though it does not require effort to listen or to observe. Like, I'm not requiring any effort to visualize what's ever in front of my eyeballs right now and to hear what's ever coming into my ears. It's when, and so listening and observing take place all the time. And it's what's put on in response or reaction to what is seen or what is heard, you know, usually in a split second. quite often imperceptible or blind to us. We're blind to it, even though we're doing it, which is the ironic part. Effort is taking place to manage what is seen, whether it's a threat, whether it's not a threat, whether we like it, whether we don't. It's all in this scale of thinking being good, bad, yes, no, all that stuff.
And that effort is again a path. That effort is again moving somewhere.
So that's where observation then has a direction versus what is taken in.
Right.
And now I'm also speaking internally as well, because you say, like, listening is an essence, and it's not just about to the birds or to the machine sounds. It's inward and outward. And that's, I think, a special, perhaps, gift of the human central nervous system or brain ability to do that inwardly, basically be aware of itself. And including its conflict or its thinking, its motivations.
Well, that's that a good way. Sorry.
Go ahead.
That's almost like a good experiment, because I think, relatively speaking, I find it's much easier to sit quietly and just attempt, or not, but the lack of attempt to hear a specific something around you shows you kind of, there's no boundary to what you're hearing. So to move that same possibility to one's whole internal experience and internal landscape is essentially, I think, what you're saying, like, that may be available to us, but we're not really ready for it, is basically what we're saying. Like, we're not built to let go so easily of, because there's a lot of noise we don't want to be a part of inside of it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you look at the world, you would say, yes, that's the case.
Well, no, I'm just saying in terms of, like, if you're sitting in the middle of the woods, you can just sort of drop and listen to the whole woods. And then eventually you can, there's something about tuning into that sort of external ear, like, just let it rush in kind of thing is available. But that capacity inwardly, which is, I think, more akin to how we're describing observation and listening, is a totally different ballgame, because it's you. And there are things you like, and there are things you don't like, and there are things you want and things you don't want. But essentially, even those preferences are the same kinds of internal sounds. Like, it's something about, so the switch between moving from building paths like you brought in to observing something seems to be, a part of that seems to be relinquishing any sense of ability to manipulate your experience. Like, no matter what you find, it's there. It's there already. But we, it's like you're saying, I'm just sort of like almost reflecting back what you said, but putting it in a different terms, because I think it's interesting to notice how easy it can be to just listen to sounds outside, but how difficult it can be to listen to all sounds inside, because some of those sounds are really a lot.
And I would propose that that's what makes something like dialogue so challenging.
Yeah.
Because you're with other reflections of yourself, mm-hmm. in a space where you're invited to hear it and receive it all. Which isn't the invitation in other kinds of social gatherings, right? There it's very clear that agreement, disagreement, identity, who I am versus who you are, dictates not only what we talk about, but what we think and is expected. Whereas dialogue, it seems, invites us to basically sit in that forest together and hear it all. And be in observation of it all.
But I like what you're saying, because I'm getting this sense of this large expanse, like a forest. That when I'm in normal mode, that all gets reduced down to a very small field. And that very small field is me and what I think and how I'm feeling and how I'm hurt and how I can't get my words out properly. And this complete concern with a very small space. Whereas you both seem to be saying there is this far wider space out there. And the difference is when I see that, or that is seen, it's there, or it's here. Whereas in my little corner, nothing seems to just be there. In my little corner, I always seem to need something else.
And in your little corner, you make it perhaps the way that you want it to move.
Yes,
whether it works
perhaps,
or not,
yes,
is another thing, but also that narrowness, I think, allows us to believe that we have some control and that there's a purpose to moving in that narrow groove.
Yes.
And obviously many things in life strengthen that belief, because that is ultimately how we all seem to function in society.
So what would make us want to look at that? What would make sense in seeing that, what you've just described, that small space, the small me, what I want and the security it gives me?
On the one hand, there's an intellectual answer to that, right? Because I think what drives many of us to come to say a dialogue is that we see what we're doing to each other in the world. We see how we are destroying each other.
Mm.
But if it only stays in that intellectual realm, that's all it will ever be, and we'll continue to come to dialogue functioning in that narrow groove. So much as we say we want to break free of it and be aware of the great expanse, will still be in that narrow groove. But it seems that, again, the reason I keep using invitation is because an invitation is something that's offered and either you take it or you don't. And it's like this continuous invitation to be in touch with this expanse, to And in a dialogue setting, it seems that what is much more clear is whether or not we're taking that invitation or not, or whether or not we are engaging in from the narrow groove or from a much more spacious. And again, to bring back this thing of what is seen is what is important. If I am in that narrow groove, to see that is critical.
So tying those two things together, would bring a person to do that? And for me, listening to this conversation, like if someone's listening to this conversation and being a part of this conversation, I am interested, based on what we've been talking about, what is listening? What is non-local listening? You know, and that is what has piqued my interest, not a desire to get over conflict or a desire to discover what love is. Those are paths. That's an ideal I'm putting at the end to get somewhere. But this idea of listening, which happens right now and is not an action, if my interest is there, and I think you just also stated that that's where the beginning is, that's where the breath of this, the living part of this truth in this moment, whether it the truth of this moment is that I'm in conflict or that I'm not, you know, is in that listening, which listening and seeing are two words that are supposedly different, but maybe not so different. I don't know. But and then out of that, the discussion really begins in terms of, okay, what are we not creating that's here? And are the words coming from that listening rather than introspection, introspective analysis, intellectual analysis, and descriptions. Like, I'm very tempted all the time to want to describe the why. Oh, why don't we do this? Well, that's because there's this me, and this me is always seeking security, and it gets so close, and it'll let it get so close, and then push away, blah, 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 blah. And that, I love that stuff. I want to tell everyone how the watch is built, but it doesn't help them to tell time. So that's why listening now is profound to me at this moment in that way.
Also, which I think is totally a part of that, is to, like, the discovery of what's listened to a bull. Like, we don't live in a world that makes your whole, like, internal landscape a venue for listening. We don't live in a culture. We don't, like, think of it that way. So to even attempt to, like, what does it even look like in terms of one's own, like, how does that work? as a question that's huge and fascinating, especially when you discover what you can uncover about yourself. We don't think of listening and seeing generally if you've spent years reading Krishnamurti, you may, like, use those words in that way, but, like, that's not common, and it's not an experience that I think we generally assume is available to just, like, see what I can find, you know, like, open. And we don't really even know how to go about doing that. And I think that's essentially what dialogue is. It's like, it's one, and I always come back to this, it's one thing to attempt to do that alone. It's a totally other thing and equally valuable for different reasons to attempt to do that with other people, because we're, in a way, swimming in the same soup, and we can show each other totally different things that, like, there are just corners I'm just not built to see in myself, but you may very well be able to point it out, and then it's available. At least I can attempt to, you know, so I do think that there is something very, like, fascinating about listening, yes, but then learning that listening can move beyond what we assume it necessarily can. Like, I think that's also
and
what may drive an interest, you know.
Do we need any background for the seeing or the listening? Does a human being need to have kind of have had to learn how to do it? Because that's what immediately comes to mind is usually what things we can do mm-hmm. is usually because we've built a capacity. And it looks like in what you're talking about and what we're talking about here doesn't even have capacity. Mm-hmm. So you're saying it's not common at all. It hardly ever happens. That's maybe why it's unique, this type of dialogue. And yet, is it something that is completely common to the human being? In other words, somebody living in deepest Australia and you know, the North Pole, that everywhere, somehow, within the human being, is there this, it's not a capacity, so what are we going to, how are we going to call it? An ability, a functioning, an ability, what could we say? A being able to see without any background, without any content, without anything having been built up as an ability to be able to do it.
Can I just share one thing? Because it relates. This is from the Book of Life. I read it the morning you asked me to do this. It was kind of funny that it was that dates thing. Can I just read it really quickly? Because it relates.
Yes.
It's entitled Listening Without Effort. You are now listening to me. You are not making an effort to pay attention. You are just listening. And if there is truth to what you hear, you will find a remarkable change taking place in you, a change that is not premeditated or wished for, a transformation, a complete revolution in which the truth alone is master and not the creations of your mind. And if I may suggest, you should listen in that way to everything, not only to what I am saying, but also to what other people are saying, to the birds, to the whistle of a locomotive, to the noise of the bus going by. You will find that the more you listen to everything, the greater is the silence, and that silence is then not broken by noise. It is only when you are resisting something, when you are putting up a barrier between yourself and that to which you do not want to listen, it is only then that there is a struggle. Thought that was interesting.
That's beautiful. I feel like we said
beautiful?
That.
I know.
but would it be good to cap it off with that, or is that too?
No, that's fantastic.
Isn't it
that's
a beautiful really, one? And yeah, isn't it no, funny how you just happen upon those things?
Yeah. The Immeasurable Podcast is a project of the Krishnamurti Center, funded by the Krishnamurti Foundation of America. For information on our online community, programs, and how to support this work, please visit kfa.org.